Trillions of dollars will change hands in the coming years. What does it mean for the country and for Maine? Much has been made about the impact of the baby boom generation on everything from the divorce rate to health care, to politics, to the workplace. Well, here's another one. The baby boom generation will have a huge impact on how money is redistributed in this country. As boomers retire or die, an estimated $59 trillion will be passed on to heirs and to charities, $29 billion in Maine alone. The phenomenon is known as the wealth transfer. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we'll look at the effect of the wealth transfer with those who are giving the money, those receiving it, and those overseeing the process among the groups directly involved. Maine Calling passes it on, but first, this news update. From the MPBN studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Over the next few decades, tens of trillions of dollars will be passed down by baby boomers to their children, their children's children, and to charitable organizations. Today, we're going to learn more about this historic wealth transfer and what it means to you, whether you're in a position to pass on your wealth or whether you hope that that money can help an organization you care about. With me in our studio, Sarah Roof Lindquist. She is the CEO of the Maine Women's Fund and a certified portfolio manager. Karen Milliken is vice president and portfolio manager at RM Davis. And Dana Baldwin is program and communications director with the Maine Philanthropy Center. Of course, we want to hear from you. What questions do you have about this coming great transfer of wealth? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mpbn.net. You can send a tweet at Maine Calling or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Thank you all for being here today. And Sarah, I'm going to start with you. I first heard about this concept of the upcoming wealth transfer at a PBS workshop about 7 years ago, but I understand it's been a big topic of discussion among those in the nonprofit fundraising worlds for even longer than that, and that much of the discussion comes out of a landmark study done in 1999 at Boston College. So I want you to sort of start us out by telling us what this study found and then how it's been updated in the years past.
Absolutely, and thank you for having me today. The two gentlemen at Boston College, Havens and Shervish, published an initial study, as you said, in the late 90s that predicted, on a conservative level, $41 trillion transferring from the boomer generation, those born between 1946 and 1964. And their conservative estimate of the philanthropic piece of that $41 trillion was $6 trillion. So lots of organizations got very excited about that. And then within 20 years, we had the Great Recession. And we've been sort of wringing our hands wondering, what does this mean? In May, they published an update to the report that I think surprised many of us, and that was that rather than $41 trillion transferring, their conservative estimate now is $59 trillion, and the portion going to charity at the level of $27 trillion.
Wow.
And that transfer is slated to happen between now and 2061.
$27 trillion transferring to charities. That's almost numbers that are really not even real.
Right, right. It's awe-inspiring.
Karen, let me ask you about this from a different perspective. I'm sure you work with a number of baby boomers and do financial planning for baby boomers who are trying to figure out how to pass on their wealth in the most responsible way. In a broad way, what do you advise them to think about, and how has that advice changed over the years?
I think the first piece of advice we try to give at RM Davis is financial planning. It's critical to the process, because you want to be able to look at your options, make decisions, and by being able to project out what your future savings are, the growth of your investments, what your retirement income needs are going to be, then you can start thinking about what we want to give to our children and what we want to give to our community. And what I'm seeing also with women, particularly, women outlive men, obviously, so they will inherit much of this wealth and be responsible for it. And what I'm seeing is when women inherit from either their spouse or their parents, or I've had many cases where it's both in a short period of time, that they need help. They want to be able to gift during their lifetime.
Interesting. And I'm guessing so many people listening will think, I would love to be in the position of inheriting something from two people at once. But on the other hand, if you're dealing with the death of someone you love and you weren't prepared for this, I'm guessing it could be overwhelming.
Absolutely. And I think that what needs to happen is having a trusted advisor, someone there for coaching, guidance, support is critical. Particularly because there are many life transitions, and some are very good, such as empty nesting, perhaps, and some can be bad, but they all have emotions. And what we advise our clients to do is to take it slow. Don't rush. It's a time when those emotions are running high and you can be vulnerable. So take a decision break for 6 to 12 months. And then when things are settling down, that's when we do a reality check and try to help you figure out what your priorities are from that point forward.
Dana, I'm certain that every charity, every nonprofit in Maine hopes that this wealth transfer will help their organization in some way. What do nonprofits need to think about? Should they be, for example, setting up special funds or programs such as charitable gift annuities or other kind of programs that reach out and touch those people who are able to give this money?
I think one of the things that the nonprofit community is really aware of is the importance of establishing real relationship with their constituents and with their potential patrons, and long-term relationships that allow for the potential donor and the potential recipient of the nonprofit to do a sort of a mission match in terms of what someone is interested in funding and what the nonprofit is driven to provide. So I think one of the most important parts of the giving trends in Maine, you know, just backing up to the Boston study, there's actually a Maine-based study in 2010 that was sponsored by a number of foundations in the state and businesses in the state, especially with rural interests. Maine Community Foundation, Maine Philanthropy Center were part of supporting this study. And that identified a $29 billion amount for the wealth transfer between 2010 and 2020. So while we're talking about a national perspective, there is a local impact that this wealth transfer could see as soon as 2020 that is major. So the nonprofit community really needs to be thinking about how they are able to create investment opportunities, really, for potential patrons and establishing a long-term relationship that where a potential donor really understands the deep meaning to the work that the nonprofit is doing.
But we're talking about a lot more than just a hope on the part of a land trust or a humane mm-hmm. society shelter or something like that, that someone will leave them some money in the will. We're talking about a whole different world now, aren't we?
Mm-hmm. And, you know, in Maine and throughout the country, you know, really the greatest support for the nonprofit work is coming from individual contributions. We talk a lot at the Maine Philanthropy Center about the importance of the foundation community, which is a very important network for nonprofits, a support system for the nonprofit community. But 75% of all charitable giving is coming from individuals. And there's an interesting thing that we find. The Maine Philanthropy Center creates a giving report on an annual basis, and we look at both foundation giving and individual giving. And Sarah and Karen and I have talked about this in prior conversations, but there's a fascinating thing about giving in Maine that is germane to this topic of the wealth transfer, in that while Maine ranks fairly lowly in individual giving on a national scale, we're actually 47th in the country in terms of individual giving.
Percentage of wealth or number? Hard number.
Hard number.
Well, we're a small state.
Right. We're 30th in the U.S. in terms of household income, okay, and 47th in the U.S. in terms of individual giving. However, we have a great distinction in the national landscape of philanthropy in terms of our giving in the form of bequests. So we're actually, quite impressive in terms of the amount of money that we make in, that we offer in terms of bequests, third in percentage of estates with bequests in the country.
Karen, you're nodding. Yeah. Is it that people in Maine are cautious in their lifetime but generous in
spirit? I think so. Very much so.
Sorry, Dana. I think I got you off.
No, I think that that is very much the case. It is a matter of making sure that what you are holding on to as important in your life is being accounted for, but then making sure that the contributions that you're making in terms of your legacy are also expressed in terms of giving.
Yes,
Sarah, I understand, and Karen touched on this earlier, how many women are controlling wealth, and that studies show women control about 60% of the wealth in the country. Why is this, and what does this mean for the discussion we're having today?
Part of the reason for that, Jennifer, is that boomers as a generation hold 90% of the net worth in the United States, which is a tremendous number.
Wow.
And then if you take into consideration that 51% of those boomers are women, and that by 2030, 54% of those boomers will be women, you can see that there's an increasing level of wealth being held by women in this country. But the other really good piece of news about that is that a 2010 study by the Center on Women and Philanthropy found that single women were more likely to give to charity and more likely to give more to charity at all income levels than single men. And that is a really interesting statistic, given that women historically have earned less, so been able to save less. They tend to be more generous. They tend to be more philanthropic overall. So to me, for women in philanthropy, it's a great story that women have, because of their longevity and because they are now bringing actually assets and income into marriages, have more assets that they're controlling.
Karen, go ahead.
But I just finished the thought. The idea that they actually now have this tremendous opportunity to make a mark philanthropically in how a majority of that $27 trillion is invested in the community is really quite remarkable, and to me a perfect storm for women in philanthropy.
Karen, idealism or philanthropy aside, there are good financial reasons, aren't there? Tax reasons for someone to pass some of their wealth onto a charitable organization.
It is it creates a win-win for the client, for the charity, in the sense that, for example, low-cost basis stock is a very good example where a client may have had this stock for many years, and if they sell it, almost 100% of it will be taxed. And by giving it to a charity, they can actually donate the stock to the charity. The charity can sell the stock to fund their operations, and the full amount goes to the charity, and the giver also deducts the charitable gift from their tax return. So very, very lucrative in terms of your tax situation.
So there's a very tangible reason to talk to someone who is a financial planner or has some real knowledge about how the tax law stands today as in terms of different kinds of vehicles.
Absolutely.
Dana, how does one think about which nonprofit to donate to? I have read in the past that Maine has more philanthropies per capita than any other state. There are quite a few options.
Yeah, and you know the nonprofit community makes a tremendous contribution to the state as well. And I think it's really important for people to think about starting with what really matters to them. You know, what part of their life in Maine has held special value to them? What need they've observed in the community where they feel like there's an opportunity that where they could make a difference. And, of course, they'll want to be thinking about the best, you know, for lack of a better term, return on their investment. You know, it is money that people have worked very hard to obtain throughout their life. And in the case of Maine's philanthropic trends, you know, thinking about trying to create something that is a longer legacy in terms of a bequest, making a bigger investment. So they'll want to be thinking about some organizations that really are going to be able to help them make their giving count. There are financial indicators that can be studied to help determine the probability of that organization's success, and they don't necessarily require a lot of, you know, intense accounting experience, but, you know, people would want to be thinking about the cash on hand that an organization has, whether there is significant cash on hand to weather, you know, some kind of unexpected storm or some economic downturn. They'll want to think about whether an organization is, you know, overly reliant on a small number of funders, or if they have a diverse funding base, whether there's a reporting system that they're comfortable with that gives them confidence in the financial management. And, you know, if the organization is less financially mature, a donor wants to think about whether the leadership has a solid plan to achieve a level of financial stability. But the comfort level that a potential donor has with any of these questions, the answers to these questions, it really depends a lot on the role that somebody wants to play in the organization's evolution. And it kind of goes back to what Karen was referring to, just in terms of broad concepts of your level, your comfort level with risk and investing. So if you think about, if you have a high level of comfort with risk in your regular investments, then maybe that is an attitude that's reflected in your contributions and your charitable donations. You might look to help a smaller, more entrepreneurial startup organization. If you are more a conservative investor in your life, and that's been your go-to way of operating, then maybe you're thinking about considering an endowment, creating an endowment that's sustaining an established organization. But in any event, a great thing about Maine and Maine's philanthropy community is that even the largest city is really a big small town. So leadership in philanthropy is always willing to talk to someone starting out, somebody who's looking for advice, someone who wants to make sure that the return on their investment in a nonprofit is making the contribution that they want for the community. And I think getting comfortable asking yourself big questions about the contribution you want to make is the best place to start. And it's really about mission match, your mission for your contribution and the mission of the organization.
Dana Baldwin with the Maine Philanthropy Center. If you would like to join the conversation, the phone number 1-800-399-3566. You can tweet at Maine Calling, email to talk at mpbn.net, or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible. As do Revision Energy, now offering Own Your Power loans for solar energy systems. More at revisionenergy.com. Woodlands Senior Living, a family-owned company whose values and commitment come from generations of providing care to Maine seniors. WoodlandsMaine.com. And Maine Coast Heritage Trust, committed to protecting the character of Maine for you and your family. Learn how at mcht.org.
Hi, this is Jennifer Ludden of NPR News. Maine and MPBN are special to me. Some of my first reporting was done there. Those stories and all the reporting I've done since were possible thanks to the support of listeners like you. This Thursday is MPBN's Super Thursday one-day drive. All the pledges of support have to come in that one day. We need your call to make this work. Please call this Thursday or pledge online. And thank you.
And that's coming up this Thursday right here on MPBN.
On a November morning in 1979, computers at the Underground Command Center of the Strategic Air Command sent an alarming message.
Suddenly, the screens were filled with images of a major Soviet attack on the United States.
It turned out to be a false alarm, but it wasn't the only one. On the next Fresh Air, Eric Schlosser discusses his book, Command and Control. Join us.
You can join us for that program this evening at 7 o'clock. Right here on MPBN Radio.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, the impact of trillions of dollars changing hands in the coming decades. With me in the studio, Dana Baldwin, Program and Communications Director for the Maine Philanthropy Center. Sarah Roof Lindquist, CEO of the Maine Women's Fund, and Karen Milliken, Vice President and Portfolio Manager for RM Davis. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mpbn.net. You can tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. First, though, we're going to go to Meredith Jones, who is CEO of the Maine Community Foundation. Hi, Meredith. I'm so glad you could join us.
Well, hello, Jennifer. This is a topic that is near and dear to my heart, and I want to pick up on where Dana Baldwin left off when she was describing how future philanthropists could think about where to place their investments. And I'm reminded of a conversation I had with a professional advisor who always is asking her clients, are you philanthropic, and how do you want to think about your legacy in terms of your philanthropy? And she is always stunned by the silence that comes in response to that question and people's general lack of understanding about the nonprofit sector. So here's my question to the three experts sitting there with you. How can we in the funder community do a better job of helping individuals who are going to be the recipients of this transfer of wealth? How can we help them be better and more effective philanthropists so that they are aligning their grant-making work with their passions, but also are thinking about philanthropy as a job, as needing to be strategic, and the things that we as funders are always thinking about? So that's my question.
Karen Milliken, do you have advice for Meredith?
We were just talking about that, and as we've been talking on the show, I've been going through my mind how many clients I've been helping with these kinds of decisions. And one client that I was helping, I asked about philanthropy, and she would very much like to give, and but we can't do it all. And so what we did was we created categories. What is important to you in your life? And is it health? Is it education? Is it developing women? Is it the environment? Is it the arts and music? So that she found very beneficial just in terms of, okay, now I have some categories that I can focus on, and I know what's near and it's clearer to me what's near and dear to me. So I think that's helpful. And then to have a list of organizations, obviously, under those categories. And she ended up saying, I really want to help the environment and I really want to help girls.
Karen, where would somebody like you, a financial advisor or a planner, get that list of organizations? I mean, is there some go-to place that you use so that you can have information about what's out there and what's possible for your clients?
You know, I don't, and I think that Dana and Sarah could probably answer that much better than I could, and it would actually be a help to me when I'm having these discussions.
I can't think of a single source, but I think each organization out there that is wanting to connect with the community of people who are going to be involved in this wealth transfer will do a great service to themselves and to that generation if they make a point of connecting with advisors like Karen and letting her know we've got a gift acceptance policy so we can look at more sophisticated options that your clients might be interested in. And if they have a passion for whatever that mission is that the organization has, we want to be sure that you know about us. So I think it's really up to the organizations to be proactive about letting the advisory community know that they're there.
Karen, I have a feeling your inbox is about to be very full. Dana, go ahead.
I was also thinking of jumping off of one of the things that Karen was saying, too, is that another, I think the education effort, maybe in answer to Meredith's question, might need to be two-prong at least. One effort might be about education for donor advisors and attorneys, people who do estate planning, to help them understand the role that philanthropy plays in the state and the importance of philanthropy in Maine and to the nonprofit community, but also to the residents of Maine at large, so that you know, the better informed advisors then know to ask the questions that Karen is even proposing to her clients. And then also, I think thinking about Meredith's question about raising awareness of the importance of philanthropy, you know, the word philanthropy and philanthropists seems that it has such a ivory tower, it's the person on the Monopoly board with the top hat and the monocle, and it's not everybody in the state who can make the contribution that they're able to make. I think raising awareness about the importance of philanthropy, but also the accessibility of giving, is a contribution that the philanthropy community might consider making together.
And Meredith, tell us about some of the way that the Maine Community Foundation thinks about community and thinks about funding. If someone wants to help a certain region, a certain town, has a certain niche, they can come to MCF, right? And look at different ways of giving.
It's funny you mentioned that, because just about an hour ago I was sending an email to somebody to describe what we refer to as our community building program, because we do have dedicated funds in 13 of the 16 counties in Maine, and these are funds that are advised by people from the county who are not only our grant makers, but they are also ambassadors for the work of the Community Foundation. So oftentimes a donor will come to me and say, I care about Hancock County. I care about Deer Isle within Hancock County, and I want to be philanthropic. So the question might then go to, can you tell me about nonprofits in those communities in Hancock County in the area of women's and girls issues? Who's doing the best work? And we will know that not because we are everywhere in Maine, but our advisors are just about everywhere in Maine, and we can identify some of those best nonprofits for donors to consider. And also, at a different level, getting back to the conversation today, it's about bequest donors. We do have donors who will say, while I am alive, I want to be able to make whatever grants I want to make anywhere in Maine or outside the state. But after I'm no longer able to advise, which is a euphemistic expression for I've died, we want that fund to be to go into the Hancock County Fund or to go into the New Lincoln County Fund. And we want people who are in that county to make those grants on our behalf. So we are very involved at the community level, and there are lots of ways of for donors and philanthropists to work with something like a community foundation or the Maine Women's Fund to really support their philanthropy.
Well, Meredith Jones, thanks so much for calling in. Meredith is CEO of the Maine Community Foundation.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay, so we have calls coming in and emails. We're going to go to Tad in Casco. This is an email who says, could you please talk about putting assets into a trust while retired? It's a whole email.
Okay,
Karen, I'm bouncing this one to you.
Well, estate planning attorneys can create a trust for you that will reflect your wishes. Sarah has a lot of experience in that area, so I'm going to let her go into more detail with that.
Trusts are very often used by people who want to avoid the public process of probate. So they'll set up a trust, put all of their assets in it, and basically have the trust written so that it dictates both how they're to be taken care of through the trust during their lifetime and then what happens to the trust assets after they die. And those can include gifts to family members, trusts for other family members, and gifts to charity.
Great. Going to, let's see if we can find that there. Judy in Belgrade. Hi, Judy. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm very enjoying this program, but with a little bit of irony, because I'm a boomer who, I'm not the first year of the generation, but pretty close to that. And it's nice to hear something positive being said about us for a change, because all the press is focused on the past several years, it seems, is how selfish we are and how self-centered and how we, you know, ruined the country in the 60s and how now we're going to suck it dry, you know, when we retire and go on Social Security. So, you know, I see all of these now when you're talking about our money, everybody, you know, they're sort of smacking their lips, waiting for us to die. So I'm finding it a little amusing, but I'm glad you're having this conversation. And I think people need to maybe understand that our generation, the boomer generation, has accumulated wealth, and most of it's been done very responsibly. And a lot of us are still taking care of our, you know, adult 30s and sometimes 40s children who, you know, don't seem to have a problem living at home sometimes. But one thing I wanted to say is when you're talking about the anticipating a certain amount of money being available, it's not just by virtue of your estate planning or what's happening on the local level. I think people, not only boomers, but everyone has to look very carefully about what could be happening on the federal level. Because when you have conversations in the Congress, and especially who controls the Congress, about rolling back Social Security or privatizing it or making it means-tested, the more boomers have to pay out for themselves, to take care of themselves, the less money is going to be available for philanthropic purposes. So I think everybody should be pretty vigilant about it. It's not a done deal now, especially, you know, how people may be taking care of a lot of their health needs that we're not taking care, that we're taking care of under Medicare for my parents' generation. And the other point I wanted to make just about the nonprofits. I've worked for nonprofits for most of my working life, and I know the struggles they have and how much they depend on philanthropy. But I do want to say that the bigger the nonprofit and the higher the salaries are for the CEO and the vice president of this and the assistant vice president of that, that is a, for people like me, a real disincentive to contribute to organizations that are really, really top-heavy with very highly paid officers. Not that people shouldn't be paid a fair share, but when you have people making $500,000, $1 million per year, you start feeling like, why, you know, is that what I'm going to be paying for?
Judy, I don't think you're alone in that frustration, but I want to have Sarah address the first part of your comment about boomers.
Well, I appreciate your thoughts, Judy, because I'm right in there with you in that generation, a little closer to the end, though. But one of my favorite sayings in this regard is if you fail to plan, you can plan to fail. And what we all have the opportunity to do is to take control and take responsibility for our situations. And I think this is one of the first times that women have actually realized, you know, my husband's always done all of this, and now he's gone, and I need to do it. Or I need to do this simply because I need to do this for myself and not rely on someone else to take care of things. And what we're seeing is more and more women who recognize that they have this increased responsibility for wealth and control over wealth, and that they want to teach their children, they want to set an example in terms of their philanthropy for the next generation to see. And so we're seeing more and more women who really want to make a difference with their wealth and want to be responsible about how they do that and find good professional advisors to work with and give their families the gift of having thought through, how do I want to be taken care of if I have a problem with my own capacity, and what do I want to make sure is there for my heirs and for the community in the form of my legacy?
The phone number 1-800-399-3566. We're going to take another short break. When we return, more of your comments and questions. Please stay with us.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Casella, committed to effectively managing non-recyclable waste while protecting the environment. Casella, giving resources new life. The Orthopedic Institute of Central Maine, committed to regaining mobility and getting rid of the pain. JointsME.org. And TechPort, offering iPad and MacBook service from broken screens to liquid spills. Learn more at TechPortMaine.com. MPBN's summer fundraising campaign will be held on Thursday, August 14th. That's this Thursday. Not starting a week-long thing on Thursday, but starting and ending on that one day, Super Thursday. It's another one-day campaign, the way it should be and can be, an efficient and relatively painless model in which we all work together to keep MPBN going. Listeners will be ready for Super Thursday, knowing MPBN radio programming is worth supporting. MPBN will make sure there are plenty of call-in opportunities, the website is awake, and we'll get it all done on that one day. Super Thursday, this Thursday, August 14th.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, a conversation about the much-anticipated wealth transfer and its impact on Maine. With me in the studio, Karen Milliken, CFA and Vice President and Portfolio Manager with RM Davis, Sarah Roof Lundquist, CEO of the Maine Women's Fund, and Dana Baldwin, who is Program and Communications Director for the Maine Philanthropy Center. We invite you to join the conversation. Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Before we go to the calls, though, Dana, I want to ask you a question about the potential impact. How could this change Maine? How in 20 or 30 years could Maine be a different place if, like the report you were referring to, if everybody who is transferring wealth transferred 5% to nonprofits and charities? How would we be different?
It's funny you asked that. Actually, the part of the 2010 study that looked at what Maine's the impact would be just in the state of Maine. Now, thinking about bequests and thinking about charitable contributions as an investment, one of the outcomes of that study predicted that if each of the $29 billion was invested and just 5% was invested in the nonprofit community and the work that the nonprofits are doing, that it would see a $92 billion. In 25 years, contributed toward the work that the nonprofit community does in the state of Maine. And I think I was thinking about what Sarah was saying before the break about what the equation of Maine's giving trends toward Maine's favor of giving through bequests and the planning that's required for that, and the thought that women are often the planners, the contributors. They're outliving spouses and making the decisions, and as we know, through bequests. That for Maine, it really is, you know, for lack of a better term, you know, it's kind of a perfect storm. It's really an equation that adds up to a significant impact of the gifts in Maine. And also, just to add, one of the things that we see at the Maine Philanthropy Center, because we work with both nonprofits and grantmaker members, we have grantmaker members, 81 of them, that range from the largest foundations in the state to the smallest family foundations, small and unstaffed family foundations. But one thing that unifies them that I see in our conversations with those members is the genuine dedication to impact, to making a difference, to making their giving count. I think Mainers are a crew that is not just interested in naming a building after themselves or making a gift so that it's a tax-deductible, you know, charitable contribution, but in really seeing change in the state in a positive way. I think regardless of the capacity to give, that's a unifier among patrons of whatever cause or nonprofit in the state. And I think if we see more that women have a higher propensity to give, that's going to make a big difference to the state with this wealth transfer.
Going to Lou and Kenny Bunkport. Hi, Lou. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm calling. Judy touched on what I was going to talk about, which is that the criteria to be used when picking a charity not mentioned was what percentage of the funds goes to the end recipients, whether in money or in food or whatever, and what percentage goes to executive salaries, overhead, and fundraising. One of my pleasures of being in Maine is that the local charity that I'm on the board of gives 99.5% of what we receive right out to people in need. And I think that's really an important criteria. And as the charity seems to grow larger, the percentage that goes to other than the recipients seems to grow as well with less money left over. So I've always found it more efficient to contribute to local smaller charities.
I also have two related emails, one from Claudia, one from Joan, both asking about the website Charity Navigator and the website Charity Watch. Do you all have any thoughts about those websites? No?
Yeah, I know there are Charity Navigator and Charity Watch are good sources to learn more about the national nonprofit community or nonprofits across the country. But I think that a great source just within the Maine community might be looking at the Maine Association of Nonprofits website. That is a really terrific organization that, you know, it's the statewide association of nonprofits that in some ways is kind of a complementary organization to the Maine Philanthropy Center. But they have a number of sources on their site that help you understand the nonprofit landscape in the state of Maine. Their website is nonprofitmaine.org.
And we've linked that on our Facebook page already. So if you go to the MPBN Maine Calling Facebook page, you can find the Maine Association of Nonprofits webpage. Lou, thanks so much for calling in. We have an email from Francis who says, or Franny, excuse me, how is the popularity of GoFundMe and Kickstarter impacting the traditional way of making donations and or long-term philanthropic planning? Does the Maine Women's Fund accept donations through Kickstarter?
My understanding of those crowdfunding platforms is that they are generally people who are wanting to be involved in helping someone get something started or get something off the ground, and it's not necessarily philanthropic, so they're not necessarily, I think in most cases, not getting a tax deduction for their gift. It's a very different world than the one that we live in as a grant maker and as an organization that raises money from the public to give
it away.
I'm
wondering, though, how the internet will change this in the future, that, you know, maybe Kickstarter and GoFundMe are not the vehicles for this, but I suspect my kids' generation is going to expect to be involved in projects over the internet when they're looking to donate money.
And where you see the largest impact of those online campaigns is in disaster philanthropy. You know, you think about the ability to make a contribution to a disaster in Haiti or another part of the world just by, you know, texting in a contribution. So, you know, we see at the Philanthropy Center that there's a tremendous surge in that kind of giving for that sort of cause. But I think in the long term, in Maine, the real concern is making a contribution that has that sticks, and that really is about the relationship between the donor and the organization.
And being involved with charities and nonprofit boards, what I'm seeing for the charities that I'm involved with is, for example, the use of auctions on the internet. So it's already beginning to trickle in by traditional nonprofits instead of just having an auction that you have to go and spend a night and have dinner and all of that. You can take a look at what they are offering and make a bid. So it's starting to creep in and being used by traditional nonprofits as well.
And I would say at the other end of those spectrums is the vehicle of a donor-advised fund. I know Meredith mentioned them because they offer them at the Community Foundation and we offer them at the Women's Fund. And so it's at the other end of the spectrum, because these are donors who really want to dig into learning about an area of funding and have the organization like the Maine Women's Fund help them decide where to best direct their gifts. As a foundation, we know a lot about the organizations working with women and girls because we look at them every year in our grants process. But these are donors that they're not wanting it to be one click away. They actually want to roll up their sleeves and learn more about what's going on in the community so that when they make an investment, they know they're making a difference. And this is an area of philanthropy that has grown by billions of dollars over the last 20 years. So I think we're going to see sort of both ends of the spectrum of donor engagement, and then technically assisted giving.
We talk about donor engagement. Are there instances, and is it something that nonprofits are wary of sometimes because they feel as though donors may try to change what it is they're doing or steer them in a direction that they might not be going into otherwise?
I think that those of us that have been around for a while know what havoc can be wrought on an organization by having a donor come in and try to really call the shots. And we all, in this conversation, I think, appreciate the idea of mission drift for an organization. And it does happen, and it's very unfortunate. But I think if you've been around the philanthropy world for a while, you realize that donors' expectations need to be managed as well. And I'm sure Karen sees this on a regular basis. I know that I have. And so it's really a level of professionalism that we have the opportunity to bring to the table in helping people understand that they're not necessarily going to become the immediate chair of the board of the organization they're supporting.
We're going to go to Ann in Portland. Hi, Ann. Go ahead.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. One, I applaud what you're talking about today, and we can all give a little, maybe more often than we do. But one of the things that I have been doing in recent years is researching Maine-based nonprofits and looking at their pie chart. It's a simple thing to get. They'll be happy to send it out to you. I don't contribute to any organization where the money leaves the state. I want what I'm donating to any organization within the state of Maine for that money to be utilized within the state. And thank you.
I suspect there are lots of people listening today who are cheering, especially those who run small nonprofits in Maine. Is this something you hear from people, Karen?
Oh, absolutely. With the nonprofits that I've worked with in the past, even though I'm an investment advisor, I help nonprofits with their finance and investment responsibilities. So that is clearly one of the requests that we very frequently see.
Anne, thank you so much for calling in. An email from Joan who writes, a few friends have involved their children in money conversations, including discussions of charitable giving. We've done the first and plan to discuss charitable giving in the near future. Karen, how involved should children and at what ages be in family decisions?
Early and often. I am a very an advocate of teaching children at a young age how to give, how to serve, having open conversations about money. And I think that is a trend that we're certainly seeing beginning to change, where families, you don't have to talk about the amounts, but you really need to give some thought to teaching children about money. I've given both my boys budget worksheets. I pass them out like floss to many clients, too. And they were so grateful to me for doing that. So as young adults now, they understand that some of their money is going to government, some of it's going to charity, and some of it goes to rent. So it's very helpful, and they're very grateful.
So we started this conversation by talking about the 1999 study that had made this great prediction for nonprofits, and then the recession hit. Here we are in 2014. Is it, and we have a number of $59 trillion, is that perhaps pie in the sky? Or do you think that there is a realistic likelihood that that's the number?
Well, when I read this, the update that came out in May, I was amazed to see the number, but then to read a little bit deeper and see that these researchers did not predict the amount of lifetime transfers that the boomers would make. They wouldn't necessarily wait until they were gone. They have made many, many more transfers, very large transfers during lifetime than they had thought would happen in 1999.
So you're saying they've given money during their lifetime as opposed to putting it in their will.
Exactly, to the next generation. And I think the Tax Reform Act that is now allowing people to give away over $5 million to family members during either during their lifetime or through death has also facilitated giving, knowing that, you know, it would have been $2 million a year a few years ago. Now it's $5 million that they can give away without tax. So it's an incentive to be generous. And the good news for charities from that is that when that group of people that has the ability to give away that amount of money either to family or to charity was asked, what would you do if there was a lower or no estate tax? What would you do to your charitable gifts? They said, we'd give more to charity because we'd have more to give. So it all makes sense to me knowing that.
Karen.
Yes, and we do economic research at R.M. Davis. It's one of my major responsibilities. And on a quarterly basis, the Federal Reserve provides data on household net worth, which has completely recovered and is at record highs right now, since the well above what it was before we went into the Great Recession. So there has been an incredible repair, if you will, of household balance sheets since the Great Recession. We have some other challenges.
Other issues, yes.
But at least that is looking on a positive trend that goes in line with the study.
Well, that positive trend is going to have to be our last note here. Thank you all for joining us. Sarah Roof Lindquist, CEO of the Maine Women's Fund. Karen Milliken, Vice President and Portfolio Manager at RM Davis. And Dana Baldwin is Program and Communications Director with the Maine Philanthropy Center. Nikki Shields ran the board today, and our intern Josh Gauthier answered your calls. We had additional help from the MPBN web team. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith. You can find past editions as well as a link to our podcast by visiting mpbn.net/Maine Calling. Tomorrow on Maine Calling, special education in Maine. Join us for a conversation with the author of The Everything Parents Guide to Special Education and a clinical psychologist. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on the Maine Public Broadcasting Network.